DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver. I'm here with our guest, James Corbett, from thecorbettreport.com. James is one of the most prolific and articulate commentators on the globe right now, and recognized. I have no idea how many countries you are recognized in right now, but I'm sure it's not just Japan where you live, and it's not just the United States or Canada where you originally came from. How many countries are Australia? I'm sure you have an impact on Australia right now. I assume they do. Why don't you give us an idea of how many countries you are broadcasting and sending radio shows into and so on?
Well, I guess every corner of the globe that has the internet can potentially tune in, and I have heard over the years from people in just about every corner of that globe. I think the only place I've never heard from anyone is Antarctica, but every other continent, certainly, and I still see new countries that I've never seen before. For example, someone from Latvia just ordered a DVD from me, so there you go. I've never been there, I don't know anything about Latvia, but I'm still getting support from people all over the globe. It's good to see.
Do you think that when you talk about receiving support from all corners of the globe, does this have anything to do with the flat earth theory, James?
I wasn't intending it to, but no.
All right, I've got to, let's start out with a silly question here, what may be a silly question. This is from Constitution.com. The headline is Latest Internet Inquiry. Did President Obama order the hit on Russia's ambassador? They're talking about the situation in Turkey. I think this is probably a silly question. Am I mistaken about that?
No, I think that would be a bit silly. But, I mean, it is interesting to me the timing of this particular event, especially because it comes at exactly the time that Turkey and Iran and Russia are meeting in talks about Syria, which is pretty interesting for a number of reasons, one of which is because these talks do not include the United States. John Kerry did not receive an RSVP for this particular round of negotiations, and the United Nations was not even informed about these talks. They're being done completely separately from any of the previous vehicles that we've seen for these types of negotiations in the past that always include the Western states and the Gulf states and what have you. So I think that's actually a pretty significant development, of course, especially coming after the breaking of the siege of Aleppo, and the fact that the Syrian government now once again controls Aleppo. I think this really could be the start towards the denouement of the Syrian debacle that we've seen over the past 5 years. And if so, what a startling, unbelievable rebuke of everything that the Western powers had as their agenda. From day one, of course, we saw Obama saying that Assad cannot be allowed to stay in power. Assad must go. And here we are, 5 years later, Assad is not only still in power, but looks like he is now even more comfortably in power than he's been in several years. And it looks like he may just survive this whole war. And now we have the spectacle of a number of powers negotiating about the future of Syria, but the United States not at that table. That's a pretty significant event. So it's interesting that at that exact moment, you have this, wrench in the works to potentially try to disrupt any sort of negotiations that are going on between Turkey and Russia. I don't think there's no indication at any rate that it's going to have that effect at this point, but that is certainly one of the things that people were speculating about as it was happening.
Why do you suppose, I've got an article here on the topic from Freedom's Phoenix, and its new headline is New York Times frantic over trilateral Russia, Iran, Turkey alliance on Syria, excluding the U.S. That's the headline. Russia and Iran supports cessation of hostilities and conflict resolution in Syria after nearly 6 years of U.S. naked aggression is the language they use. And is the reason the United States is excluded? Could it be because the United States is responsible for fomenting the conflict in Syria?
Well, I certainly think that's part of it. But then again, Turkey is not exactly blameless in all of this, and they're at the table, so make of that what you will. But I certainly think that it is recognized at this point that the United States never has and never could be an honest broker of peace in Syria, because they have been committed openly, the President of the United States has been committed since day one to ousting Assad, which, you know, is not a very nice negotiating point to stand from if you are the President of Syria. So I understand why the United States is being excluded, and I think that has to be part of it, that basically this is a rebuke of the regime change that has been the goal, and which I think... I mean, again, this is, if this is the end of the road for this, this is a pretty remarkable point, because, again, let's keep in mind the context of this coming right after the Libya NATO invasion, and it looked like Syria was just going to be the next domino to fall, and it didn't fall, it hasn't fallen, and it might not fall. And that is a significant rebuke to that imperial agenda in the Middle East.
It's also, it raises questions about the power of the United States to impose its will. In theory, Syria is a small and not very powerful country. How is it that the Obama administration failed to impose its will in that country?
Well, I would say that the key difference is that Libya's key foreign cooperator, who may not be on the U.S. side of things at the time that it was invaded, was China. And that was really more an economic cooperation and involved more Chinese engineers and what have you working on the oil rigs in Libya, more so than actual... any sort of military assistance, whereas Syria has and maintains an actual Russian naval base, which obviously has significant military power behind it, and they are operating with surface-to-air missiles that have been supplied by the Russian government that have absolutely foreclosed on that possibility of a no-fly zone, or at least an unproblematic no-fly zone being unilaterally imposed from the outside. So I think that is the key deciding difference. Ultimately, Russia kind of rolled over and looked the other way while the debacle in Libya was happening. They did not look the other way as the Syria became the next on the chopping block, and I think that's the fundamental difference to what happened here.
I've got another headline here. It says, Israel shifting strategies to prepare for long-term Russian presence in region. If the Obama's war against Syria's President Assad has failed, did that failure cause Russia to enter the Middle East in a way that they hadn't? Is that what opened the door for Russia to come into the Middle East? And if so, did Obama's failed war against Syria's President Assad cause Russia to enter the Middle East on a permanent basis?
Well, as I say,
are they just transitory, go in, resolve the problem in Syria and Russia's gone? Or is Israel correct to assume that Russia's going to be there for a long time?
Well, the Russian naval base already existed there, so that's nothing new. And I think there will be a Russian presence at any rate for that base alone. But I think Russia's importance and the fact that they are one of the main players at the table now negotiating towards the endgame in Syria is reflective of the fact that they have been made a centerpiece of all of this because, again, they had their interests that they stood up and did not allow to be rolled over. And I think the deciding moment in that was mid 2015, I believe it was, when Russia began its own bombing campaign of ISIL targets, and of course targets that were also part of the rebel insurgency that were closer towards its interests in the western part of the country. And that was a decisive moment at which Russia stopped playing along, even giving lip service to the kind of agreements and negotiations that were going on the international stage. So I think it has made Russia into a more important player, certainly in Syria, and it has fostered these interesting military and strategic alliances that we've seen, data sharing that's now going on between Iraq, Iran, and Russia, for example, about what's happening in Iraq and in Syria. These types of things are natural developments of what have been going on the ground in Syria, and obviously they have forwarded an agenda which shows that Russia is a more integrated part of what's happening on the ground these days, and certainly more integrated than the United States, which has continued to act as kind of a power from the outside, unwilling to commit any troops, and so using Turkey as a proxy force in the region. It's very interesting to see that shift take place, and it really does, I think, it does pretend a change for in the dynamics of who's going to be on the ground, actually acting in the region in the future. I think there is a tendency to make, now that Russia is becoming the big boogeyman, I think there is a tendency to make it into a more important world power than it really is, or even could possibly be, given it the fact its entire GDP is about equivalent to that of, I believe, Spain. It's not exactly a world powerhouse in any sense, and militarily it's only so because, really, of its nuclear arsenal and a few trinkets that they have. But ultimately, it's not really the type of world-dominating power that it's being made out to be, but just the fact that people are treating it as if it is this world-dominating power has, I think, increased its ability to act in the diplomatic space internationally.
Why is it being portrayed as a world-dominating power?
I think
what's the objective?
The neocon clique did, of course, not go away after the Bush years, and they have just morphed into other organizations, the Foreign Policy Institute and what have you, that are still enacting a very neocon-centric foreign policy that has, to some extent, continued in the Obama years through the State Department, through people like Victoria Nuland, married into that neocon clique via her husband. So there are still those ties and those players, and they have, for a very long time, been making Russia into the next boogeyman, as it were, as a convenient part of their longer-term strategy of projecting American power around the globe for the next century and all of that. Project for New American Century type rhetoric. The Kagans and what have you are still there and still players, powerful players in Washington, or have been at any rate. And I think that's part of what this 2016 presidential selection cycle was about. I don't think Trump was a savior. I don't think it's, you know, fundamentally going to change the nature of the universe. But I really do think that the neocons had coalesced around Clinton, and the Russia is the boogeyman type of line that they were promoting is the U.S. State Department's sort of status quo that they were hoping would be maintained. I think the incoming Trump administration, from all of its rhetoric so far and from the appointments that it's making, looks like it is going to be something of a rapprochement with Moscow, and that ire is going to be more directed towards Beijing. And part of that, I think, is going to be a strategy in the Trump administration to drive a wedge between Russia and China, which will be interesting to see if and how that takes place and if that can be accomplished. But at any rate, it's just a different strategy and a different target that's now being targeted. So I think we're seeing the last gasp of the Russian boogeyman neocon strategy in this CIA leak of information that they can't show anyone, of evidence that they may or may not have, that Russia may or may not have somehow quote-unquote hacked the election, whatever that actually means. I think that's really the dying gasp of that neocon clique that was looking to get the Cold War 2.0 launched.
When the Soviet Union collapsed, one of the things that I saw at the time was there was really no celebration in Washington, D.C. After years of complaining about the evil empire and one thing or another and what a bunch of wicked SOBs the Russians were and the Soviet Union was, when it finally collapsed, it seemed like it was as if there was a death in the family in Washington, D.C. And the point is, they needed their boogeyman. How could they function without the boogeyman? And the reason I bring that up is, what about right now? If the neocons are determined to portray Russia as a world-dominating power and some sort of a boogeyman, can they really afford to bomb them into the Stone Age?
Oh, of course.
Because
not,
if they
no.
do, will they lose? Do they have another boogeyman waiting in the wings?
No, I think.
Or do they have to keep that boogeyman? They can. Oh, look what he did! Look what he did! But never actually hurt him.
Yes, I think this is more intended as Cold War. This is why the Cold War rhetoric keeps coming up these days. Is because I think it really is or has been intended as a continual provocation. They are the enemy. They are the boogeyman. But I don't think actual full-on military confrontation was or is part of that plan. I don't think it's even necessary, really. And as you say, as you allude to, the Cold War was primarily about having that boogeyman, which allowed, of course, not only the buildup of the military-industrial complex, but also towards cracking down on civil liberties at home and denouncing any dissent as communism. And And also, of course, it's always good to facilitate that fear in the public, to make them rally around the flag. I think all of those effects are what was being looked for in this Cold War 2.0. And for all of those reasons, I don't think an actual hot military confrontation was really or is really the agenda for these neocons and others that want to foment this.
Well, that's, you know, it makes you wonder why are they doing this exactly? You're saying it's not because the neocons necessarily want war and destruction, or at least you're implying that. It's saying that they want control over the people they already have significant control. They want more control. The neocons, you at least imply that they are working more against the American people than they are against the Russians. They're using the Russians as an excuse to diminish freedom in the United States. Do you really believe that? Reading the implication correctly?
I think that is one way of looking at it. I think the key phrase that came out of the Bush administration years was full spectrum dominance, that the Pentagon wanted to achieve full spectrum dominance all over any perceived threat, and in order to maintain American hegemony through the 21st century. And what that means is, of course, the threats to the Pentagon can be Russia or China or outside threats. They can equally be people who dissent to the system from inside that system. So certainly, I think the American public has quite demonstrably been one of the primary targets of the Department of Homeland Security, for example, that says anyone who wears blue jeans or quotes the Constitution is a potential terrorist and things like that. I think it's always been using the boogeyman to build up the apparatus of the machinery of the war, the police war state, in order to make sure that any potential citizens who might not go along with that agenda might get caught up in that dragnet.
Do you know if we have any Supreme Court justices who wear blue jeans? I know they all quote the Constitution from time to time. Do you know if any of them are wearing blue jeans? And if so, does that make them terrorists or potential terrorists?
Hard to see under the robes, I guess. But,
All right. I tell you what, we've got about 30 seconds before we take a break. Why don't you give us a fast pitch on where they can catch the Corbett Report?
CorbettReport.com
and what they can expect to see.
CorbettReport.com is the one-stop shop for all of my media, audio, video, articles, others. And, of course, it is it's completely free to the public, but it is supported by listeners out there. So if people want to sign up, you can subscribe to my weekly newsletter and or you can get DVDs there as well.
Okay, we're going to take a break for a couple commercials. I'll be right back with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CORBETT. Report.com. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adusk here with James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com discussing world events and geopolitics and whatever comes to mind. Here's one for you, James, that I think you'll kind of enjoy. This is from Zero Hedge. And the headline is New York Times will vacate 8 floors in its headquarters to generate significant rental revenue. I'm not sure if you've seen that report already, but how do you interpret that?
I have seen that report, and I think that's another positive sign of the death of the dinosaur media. And that, I mean, as I'm sure listeners to programs like this don't need to be told, has a lot to do with the absolute abdication of any sort of journalistic responsibility, or at least the pretense of journalistic responsibility on the part of these establishment media institutions over the past decade at least, and certainly going much further back, but certainly since the time of the Iraq War and the complete debacle as that played out. I think we've seen the backlash against dinosaur media of various types, but certainly print media, the newspaper industry, is feeling the pinch most acutely, because the newspaper really is an antiquated institution in this day and age. So it is not really surprising to see newspapers floundering to find a way to stay relevant in the 24/7 online digital age. So we don't even have to go into the history of the New York Times and its various deceptions on the American public to account for this. I mean, it's just, to a certain extent, just economics, but it's hard not to take a bit of schadenfreude in a story like this.
I understand. We've got the New York Times as a physical newspaper, an actual paper document, appears to be having some trouble. Are they going to be able to make the transition to become a purely digital document and retain their former influence?
I sincerely doubt it. And I think it's fascinating to watch the ways that newspapers have tried to grapple with the going online and failed to do so in any way that generates significant revenue. They are able to generate advertising revenue, obviously, but I don't know if it's a sustainable model in the way that the former institutions like the New York Times used to be, was. And that is being reflected in the fact that we've seen more and more of those types of outlets going to a system whereby if you'll get, say, 10 free articles per month that you can view, after which point it will come up with a little thing saying you must subscribe to see more articles. Which is, I mean, I think it's honestly does not understand the reality of the internet or what the internet, how the internet functions, because ultimately all you are doing is shooting yourself in the foot. You are basically turning readers away who may otherwise be interested in your website. I don't think that's going to be an ultimately sustainable model. And certainly towards your second part of your question there, will they be able to retain the influence that they had? I certainly don't think so. If you're putting these paywalls in front of your articles, how are you going to be able to maintain that influence that you had when this was so widely disseminated and one of the only the sort of national news sources that people could turn to? Again, I just don't think it's reflective of the reality that we're living in, and it's another sign that it is harder to create those centralized institutions in this day and age. And that's, I don't want to go overboard with it. There is a certain loss that we get from the move to from the print media to the television and radio media and into the digital media, in that we do tend to lose the kinds of massive machinery of institutions that are necessary in order to produce exceptionally in-depth reporting on a number of subjects. It's difficult to maintain a perspective on things without having a foreign bureau and in every major country and things of that sort. But that is balanced by the fact that now the information itself is decentralized and potentially available to almost anyone at a click of a button. So it's going to be interesting to see how and if and when and in what way the forces of centralization will work to try to centralize what is increasingly a decentralized and quote unquote chaotic news collection, news gathering space. I think there is a lot of potential for something really innovative and new to come up in the field of open source journalism, but institutions like the New York Times and others that are putting up these paywalls, I think, are going in the exact opposite direction.
Well, when you talk about open source news media, that's exactly what you're doing with the Corbett Report, as I understand it. And what you're relying on is the information is available from hundreds of sources, but sometimes what people need is not simply the information, they need somebody to connect the dots. Is that the essential idea behind open source journalism as compared to New York Times, for example? And the one thing you were going to lose here, they used to pay for investigators. They had journalists who actually investigated stories. Right now we get stories, but I don't know if we get investigations to go along with them to the same degree we might have, say, 25, 50 years ago.
That's right. And I think that's what I was hoping to gesture towards there. And of course, when we look at the ways that these establishment media institutions have been and have always functioned in the service of power, maybe that's not necessarily, I mean, the huge loss that it could be, because obviously a lot of these reports were controlled and you're never going to read anything about 9/11 truth or what have you in the New York Times, because that it certainly isn't in their interests to report on such things. So that side of it, of course, will not be missed. But as you say, the kind of really in-depth reports and reporting that at least would be possible in an institution like that, there is a loss that is being felt. And I think people can see that in the kind of surface way that a lot of online media treats their subjects. And I think that's even being reflected in reality at this point by the fact that we have these crazes and manias that come and go so quickly that are even part of the news cycle at this point. Remember when Pokemon Go was the story of the, wow, this is an amazing phenomenon, and it seemed to be here for a week or two, and then who even remembers what that was about? And that seems to be the way a lot of these stories are happening now. And
but I think not all of them. Witness the Kardashians.
Yeah.
It appears that they're going to be here on Mount Rushmore before this is all over.
But
they may be here for generations.
Let me offer the outside perspective on that, because here I am in Japan. So I know of the cultural phenomenon of the Kardashians. I've heard of them a million times. I've never seen any television show with them in it. I don't look at the types of websites that cover them. I kind of just know them through the cultural zeitgeist, but I think that even the ability for that sort of thing to capture the national attention, I think that is being chipped away at. I think we're arriving at the point where I'm not sure those types of celebrities who are celebrities for being celebrities can exist in the environment that's being created right now, where everything is so decentralized. I think what we're seeing is the creation of micro-celebrities, where you have like YouTube celebrities, people who will be exceptionally well known amongst their particular niche of their particular corner of the internet, and maybe exceptionally popular. And, you know, everyone under the age of 18 will know PewDiePie, and everyone over the age of 18 will go, what on earth is PewDiePie? And that is, I think, more an incredible intensification of the sort of localization of the idea of celebrity. Not localization in a geographic sense, but in a demographic sense at best, and maybe even just in terms of interests. And I think that's probably to the good, creating communities of interest rather than communities that are created just by the fact that we all live in the same geographic area and all watch the same program being beamed into our television every night is, I think, a more human way of living, because we do tend to gravitate around things that we are interested in rather than things that are foisted on us. So I think there is some good to come out of that. And I wonder if a Kardashian-type phenomenon can arise in the next decade in the same way that it did in the previous decade.
Well, I'm sure there are a number of politicians that hope they can, looking to set up a family dynasty, which is a little Kardashian-like. But what you're talking about is more evidence that there's a serious backlash against central government, central control, big business, big government, and the system is kind of disintegrating. And I don't necessarily mean that it's falling apart, but it's we're going to pay attention to a couple of blogs that I'm particularly interested in that won't be the New York Times and won't be something that's well-known, and yet I'll have my own interests, you'll have yours, and so on. Is that going to be a good thing when we get away from this central control? Is that going to work out for us without major problems, or is it inviting new problems?
Well, I certainly don't think it's all sunshine and rainbows, but as someone who does tend to want advocate for the radical decentralization of everything, I do tend to see the positive sides of it. But I think I would only disagree with your assessment of the situation in that you framed it in the context of this being a backlash against centralized institutions and bureaucracies and what have you. I don't think it's actually a conscious backlash of any sort. I think it's just a natural extension of the media space, technological devices that we have now to interact with each other. It has to become more decentralized because, again, I think it's more reflective of human nature. The only reason there was these cultural touchstones and icons and things that everybody knew on around the water cooler on Monday morning was because we all were fed the same maybe three choices if you grew up in an earlier area, or maybe 12 choices or whatever of what to watch on TV. So everyone kind of knew basically what everyone else was thinking and watching. But that is an exceptionally unique and rare instance in the course of human history, because mass media has only existed for the past 100 years, arguably. And before that point, people were more grouped into communities where people could diversify in terms of their interest. And I think we're, and to some extent, this is a return towards something like that, except on a global scale instead of a local scale, which just means there is the possibility to get more and more specialized into your particular niche of something that you're interested in, which can actually, I think, create some of the new problems that you're alluding to, as people getting too caught up in narrower and narrower echo chambers. And that could be a problem of the future, but it's certainly quite a different problem than the problem of the mass homogenization of culture that we've seen over the past century.
I think that mass homogenization, I think that laid the foundation for huge nations. Could we have had the United States of America without some sort of mass communication, mass culture, where everybody understood when you went to the water cooler that here were the topics of the day, and everybody agreed on that? There was a kind of consensus, and it created at least the illusion that we were all on the same side. Now we go to the water tower, when we sit down and start talking together to each other, it's a little bit more like the Tower of Babel.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. We don't have that consensus where we all agree that today's story is such and such, and we can talk about that. You got a story, I've got a story, everybody in the audience has a different story. It's a little bit like, it reminds me of the Tower of Babel.
Yes. It's an interesting phenomenon. And I think this might be one of those things where the fish can't see the water that they're swimming in. Myself being born in Canada, yourself in the United States, I think we sometimes can fail to appreciate that the kind of mass national culture there is some regional differences here and there, but there is kind of a mass national culture that exists. And you just think of, it's Canada, it's America. But my roots, my family roots being in England, you go to England and every 20 miles, there's a different area with a different dialect with different people, and they generally hate the people 20 miles away from them. And there's that intense, small, local, geographical identity that each little county has. That is so important in the old style European sense, because there was no mass communication when those communities were being formed. The Canada and the United States being formed in eras of greater communication and ultimately the telegraph and radio and ultimately into the television created that kind of national space. I think you're right about that. So what's happening now, I think, is not, it's like those tiny communities that you would build identity around in the old world, so to speak, except it's now happening not geographically, but in terms of interest. Which is, that's a fascinating phenomenon.
I know.
It will be interesting to see the types of political structures that ultimately get foisted upon this, because, of course, the politicians and political structures will always try to come and contain or capture that. And we may be moving into a world where our geographical location will not be our determining in terms of our nationality. I mean, can you have a nation of a distributed nation through online? Is there some way of forming communities of interest that are somehow real but also virtual? These are the types of things that will be more preoccupying humanity in the decades to come. It will be fascinating, and in some ways I'm sure it will be horrifying, but there's always the potential that it could be used positively for the positive ways that it could free humanity.
That's always been the potential, hasn't it?
As always, it's up to us about what we make on it. And maybe that's the note to end 2016 on, because a lot of people have a lot of dread about what's coming in 2017. But as always, whatever happens, it's going to be us acting with those around us in ways that are positive and community building, or ways that are negative and wall building. And I don't know, it's up to us which ways that we personally interact in that.
We are not helpless pawns, is what you're saying.
I like to think not, anyway.
I think you're right. I think you make a good point. We don't have enough time. We're down to 10 seconds, so we can't get into that exactly. But the question then is, if we're not helpless pawns, we do have to become individually responsible. You have power. I have power. Each of the people in the audience have power. They have to be responsible for using it, not only using it correctly, but using it, which takes a certain amount of courage. We're out of time. I want to thank all you folks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Melody. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, James Corbett, and Todd, the producer. Thank you, James, for being on the program. Always enjoy it.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.